is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour. My name is Annie Brown. Hope you're doing well this Monday. Hope you had a Merry Christmas as well. Had a nice little break, hopefully. And definitely something good to eat. It is the time of good food this time of year. Today on the program, remember back in March when President Trump announced his Liberation Day tariffs? Well, if you cut to now, Australian beef exports are at record levels, and more of his tariffs actually helped open up more markets for Australian exports. So how did tariffs actually help Australian beef producers? We're going to delve into that. It's been an extraordinary year in Australian beef exports, 2025. Also, have you been experiencing weather whiplash these last few weeks? From torrents of rain to 40 degrees to high winds, we even saw frosts at the start of the month. We've kind of seen it all. And for some, it's good news, and for others, it's bad news. So we'll talk about the toll that the changes in weather is taking on farmers as well this afternoon. But if you are listening out today, I want to know, what are you up to? Because this is a kind of a funny week in the time of year that it is, the last week of the year. Lots of people are out on holidays or out of the office, but farmers, you work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So what jobs are you up to at the moment, and what are you doing out there? You can always send us a text, 0467 842 722. Send us a photo as well, or you can give us a call on 1300 147 222. What are you up to this time of year? First up, though, while many of us were dreaming of sugar plums on Christmas Eve, a bunch of CFA volunteers were called out to a haystack fire near Bridgewater. Stephen Fosser is the local landowner and was the incident controller on the night as well. He told Emma Field what happened.
My CFA pager went off and we got called out to a hayshed fire approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, and three units attended. And Bridgewater sent two of those.
And what was the scene like when you got there?
The hayshed was fully engulfed. There was nothing we could do at that stage other than make sure that the fire didn't spread. So we just basically had to sit and watch it burn and watch the shed collapse.
Is it very common, hayshed fires?
Yes, unfortunately. With the introduction of these new high-pressure balers, we attend a lot of hayshed fires, and we're getting quite good at knowing how to control them or what you can and can't do with them. And well, we used to try and pull them apart and try and put them out, but now we just let them burn because you can't extinguish them once they start.
So what is it about these high-pressure balers that you think they think causes the fires?
Oh, just the haze. Under so much pressure now, with your old rolls of hay, you didn't get the same pressures, but with the modern square balers, it's very high pressure, and you only need a piece of damp hay the size of a football in the middle of a stack, and it will ignite. It's very hard to guard against that.
So is it a combination of the dampness plus the heat? Is that what happens?
Yes, yeah. If the hay's not cured properly, and it's under such high pressure, it just self-ignites.
And so Christmas night or Christmas morning, how long were you there for, and what did your day look like after that?
Oh, well, I had all my family home for Christmas, but we got the call at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I got home after organising a couple of different crews. I got home about 5 o'clock and then had an hour of sleep, and I got back to the site 8 o'clock and babysat the fire until about 12 when we handed over to the owner after making sure that they'd put a firebreak around it and that he had water. And, we had to sign the fire over to him.
So that's a pretty unusual Christmas morning for you.
It has happened before, actually. That's just part of being in the CFA.
And despite all the issues that have gone on with the CFA this year, you know, with the extra levy and things like that and the protests, you know, people are still willing to get out of bed on Christmas Eve and go to their neighbour's fire.
Yes, yeah. it's just what we do. Even though we're very angry with the government over the way we've been treated, if we don't put the fires out, who does? And it affects everyone.
And so what happens to that fire now? How long do you reckon it'll burn for?
Oh, it'll burn for at least 2 weeks, possibly three. It's just a matter of keeping an eye on it and making sure it can't escape and do any more damage.
So do you have concerns that there could be windy conditions? Is that something that you're a little worried about?
The conditions were fairly windy on the night, which is why we put in a very large mineral earth firebreak around the whole shed and the whole property, so it couldn't escape.
And going forward, do you worry that it's that it might escape, or do you think what you've got in place is pretty good?
No, the fire will get smaller and smaller as it burns, and unless we have catastrophic conditions, it should be safe.
Now, Stephen, you have a bit of land there in Bridgewater, and you've got some crops and livestock. How'd your crops go this year?
Actually, we were very happy. Much higher yield than we were anticipating. And our barley went malting, so, yeah, we were very happy with the year. Land prices are really exceptional, and, we couldn't complain. We were looking at a bleak future for a little while it was so dry, but no, it picked up, and, we're very happy with the outcome of the year.
And what kind of stock do you have there?
We were running crossbred ewes just to grow fat lambs mainly.
And you think these high prices will remain? What's your tip for 2026?
My information is that they could even go a little bit higher yet. The prices usually peak in February, March, and I think they can go even a little bit higher yet.
Well, he's hoping you're right, Stephen.
Well, a lot of people will be hoping because a lot of people are buying store lambs at very high prices. So, I hope I'm right.
That was Stephen Fawcett, CFA volunteer and a farmer who was out monitoring a hay shed fire near Bridgewater on Christmas Day there. Amazing job the CFA volunteers do there. We also have been told that a CFA volunteer said that the community will see smoke from this fire for the next few weeks, so be aware of this before you ring and report any smoke, because apparently lots of people have been reporting the same fire, and as Stephen mentioned there, it will burn for a couple of weeks. If you want to look up any fires that are happening and get the latest information, you can also look at the Vic Emergency map and the website, so that's emergency.vic.gov.au if you want to get a bit more information. Now, a strong contender for the 2025 Word of the Year, I think, could be tariffs. Back in March, President Donald Trump announced a 10% tariff on Australian beef imports into the US. But cut to now, into December, and we're experiencing record beef exports and the US becoming a leading destination. Independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty said, in the end, tariffs were actually very advantageous for Australian beef producers.
I mean, shipments, I think up until November, were just on about 410,000 metric tons for Australia. And they are our number one market. So if tariffs were a means in which to dissuade people from shipping there, it did quite the opposite, for us at least.
Well, let's go back a little bit in the year 2025. So it was in March when President Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs were announced. He said Australia didn't import US beef and placed a 10% tariff on Australian beef. Here's a bit of what he said back in March.
They ban American beef, yet we imported $3 billion of Australian beef from them just last year alone. They won't take any of our beef. They don't want it because they don't want it to affect their farmers. And you know what? I don't blame them, but we're doing the same thing right now, starting about midnight tonight, I would say.
So back in March, there was a bit of panic about that announcement, wasn't there?
There was, but I think in reality, Australian beef in particular, lean beef, is a necessary item. It's a necessity because they simply don't produce enough of their own lean beef. Even though there were threats, I think in the end, it's pretty clear that on beef, and I think to a certain extent lamb, that we saw within that week or 2 weeks of that announcement beef prices in Australia and lamb prices actually rise on the back of stronger demand.
Why does the US need so much of our beef?
Well, basically, they've been in liquidation for many years, and their herd sits, at a 70-odd year low, and overall, they're in deficit. Now, when you have a smaller herd, and in particular, that they have been relying on increased carcass weights to try to make up for a declining herd over these many years. But that means fewer cows in the system, and with fewer cows comes less lean beef. So effectively, one area that they are particularly deficient of is lean beef, and both Australia, Brazil, and New Zealand play a critical role in the supply of lean beef. So you could argue that we are truly complementing their needs, basically in an area which will not fix itself because of the nature of their industry, because of, 90% of animals on feedlot and a decline in the overall herd size. The humble hamburger is in very much huge demand, and with the high cost of living, ground beef continues to be the number one item sold throughout America's retail sector.
So let's go back to the tariffs that were implemented back in March and were lifted in November. So it was about 8 to 9 months though that 10% tariff was on Australian beef. I guess, who footed the cost of those tariffs in the end?
To me, it was all passed through to the consumer at the other end. And we saw that literally within the first 3 days in March when Trump introduced this. US imported 90s jumped 20 cents a pound within 4 days. So that's highly unusual, and that tells you that they needed it and they stepped up and paid for it immediately. So I think all the indications were there, and as I said at the start, both Australian beef cattle and lamb rose in that period for the first, because pretty well it was all passed forward and they need the protein with such shortening supply within their own country.
Any impact here on Australia? Well,
there was enormous, Annie, the impact, because not only were their demand within America was better, but American beef, which they are our number one competitor globally, particularly on grain-fed beef, because of the inflationary impact of tariffs, saw offerings out of America into Korea, Japan, and pretty well every other country that we compete with America in move higher. And Australia therefore got all the benefits of not just higher prices in America, but higher prices across the globe, because America was pushing prices higher thanks to Donald Trump and his inflationary tariffs.
So Australian producers really were the winner out of all this, it sounds.
Well, it didn't stop just there either, Annie, in terms of the wins. We also saw America's access into China stop. So by chance, under the Phase One agreement that America had with China, that was due for all the licenses to be reinstated in March. And the Chinese said, no, we're not reinstating those. So effectively then, as each license ran out of its legitimacy, we saw US beef stop flowing into China, and Australia once again filled the void. And demand for Australian beef into China was extraordinary this year.
Simon, what do you think are the key takeaways from the year 2025 when it comes to Australian beef and exports?
I think the key takeaway is that we remain, I guess, light on our feet. I think that we, what could have been a very challenging year for both beef and lamb proved to be actually a very good year. I think that next year we've seen that consumer demand in America still remains incredibly strong and robust. So, the latest figures show that beef was up for the month of November 8% in price, and for the year up 4.1% in volume. Annie, that is the definition of strong demand. Higher prices and more volume going into the market. So the net effect is, I think that momentum flows into next year, that Australian beef and lamb will be the beneficiary of this stronger environment. It won't last forever, but at the moment, we're seeing very little pushback in this environment by consumers. There's so many other things to talk about, the benefits. Key benefit was that Brazil incurred a tariff of 50% on top of what was already a high tariff of 26.4% because they'd filled quota at the start of this year. So it became cost prohibitive for Brazil to export into America for the majority of this year. Once again, Australia was the place importers turned to because of the high tariffs that Brazil was up against versus our own 15%, 76.4% versus 15. So demand due to Brazil's very inflated tariffs for Australian beef was exceptional, particularly on lean. But the other key thing that came out of this, Annie, is that when Donald Trump put tariffs of Japan, Korea, the EU at 25% initially, and in some instances even higher, our deep concern was that they would all go into recession. And they're our key markets outside of America to buy. So when eventually those tariffs were reduced to 15%, which is very manageable, then Japan, Korea, the EU could continue to buy Australian beef and lamb at very affordable levels and keep pace and avoided recession. So the key take home there is that the lowering of tariffs to 15% to all our other key markets ensured demand for Australian beef and lamb remained robust.
It's an amazing story, really, when you think about the panic that sort
Annie,
of set
it's
in.
It's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? It really, Donald Trump almost did us a favor in many ways, it sounds. Yeah.
He did. And until you break it into each of their own a significant events, it just that there was so much of it going on at once, that the stars aligned for Australia in so many ways because of tariffs. All those tariffs have been removed, but does this demand continue? And my answer is it probably does, but not at the same pace. But the fundamentals of supply shortage globally, and we're going to see it out of Brazil, Australia and America, because each will go into their own rebuild, will ensure that prices continue to be firm and rise even further next year.
That is independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty there, giving us a bit of a rundown on what tariffs did to Australian beef and lamb exports this year. Not so bad in the end. I wonder what your word of the year is. I reckon it could be tariffs. It's been a pretty extraordinary year. Tariff could be a word that I heard a lot more this year than I ever heard before. I did look it up, though. The Macquarie Dictionary did announce earlier this year that the word of the year for 2025, they deemed, was AI slop, had been voted. It beat out other shortlisted like Blind Box, Ozempic Face, Bird Dogging and 6-7. AI slop refers to low quality content created by generative AI, which often contains errors and is not requested by users. I don't know. What was your word of the year for 2025? How could you sum it up? 0467 842 722. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
The Country Hour. Celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Yeah, my name's Doug Peachy, and what is it, the Country Hour's 80th birthday? And I've listened to it, I reckon, for the last 40 to 50 years and still enjoy it very much. A bit of everything, the variety, the weather, the market reports, covers a big area, like from vegetables right through to livestock, crops, everything. It's entertaining every day. Congratulations and enjoy another 20 years.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
It's 25 minutes past 12 here on the Victorian Country Hour. My name's Annie Brown. Now, roughly 30,000 tonnes of food scraps and green waste will soon be put towards creating fertiliser and compost for agricultural use in central Victoria. The new development will be located in Huntley, next to the Livestock Exchange. Western Composting Technology Chief Executive Matt Dickens spoke with Timu King about the project.
So we tended for this circular economy project back in 2020, I'm going to say, or it might have been 2021. It was delayed through that period of COVID. So it's been, we've been negotiating with council for, you know, almost 4 years now. The approval process with the EPA for our development licence took much longer than anticipated, about 14 months, whereas I think the statutory period should be 4 months. And then the cost of building the facility over that period of time almost tripled. So it's been in the works, I guess, for four to five years now.
Where I understand it coming into the circular economy is the food scraps and food waste. Where in the region are you putting it that makes sense?
We're putting it on council-owned land adjacent the Livestock Exchange in Huntley on Wellingeau Road. So it's co-located next to what you'd say are compatible land uses, which is the sow yards and a nearby sewage treatment plant.
It's a broad range of food scraps and input. What is the product going to be at the end?
So the product's usually defined by particle size. So we have what you'd call a premium product, which is 16 mil minus, coarser 16 to 30 mil product, and then a coarser mulch. That coarser mulch does require a fair bit of cleanup because that's where most of the contamination that's present in the feedstock material that comes to us from the curbside collections is present.
Do you expect your primary customers are going to be? Is it going to be domestic gardens, or is it going to be more industrious, broad scale agriculture?
Yeah, I think it's going to be agriculture. We're going to be a wholesaler, so we're not going to be bagging the product and selling it retail. As I mentioned, in Shepparton, intensive agriculture would be our main market in the Bendigo region. To a certain extent, broadacre farming, although we are limited by the throughput that's going to go through the facility. Currently, we're going to be licensed to process 30,000 tonnes of material per year. So we likely produce around about 14,000 tonnes of compost, of finished product.
Do you happen to know what the overall tonnage of food waste from the Bendigo region is?
So it's food and garden organics, that 30,000 tonnes I referred to. The percentage of food might be something like 3,000 tonne, around about 10% by weight. There is scope for more recovery as the reforms are, you know, bedded in and those habits, recycling habits in households improve.
What's the timeline like? Mm-hmm. How long until the plant is up and running?
So we just started civil works last week. They'll continue for at least until February, March. The build time for the tunnels and the receival building, biofilter, etc. is relatively short, so, you know, 3 to 4 months. So we're hoping by July, August 2026 that the facility will start dry commissioning and then wet commissioning. That process will probably go for up to 6 months. So we'd be looking at being fully operational by the start or around the start of 2027. We're involved in a tender process for the Ballarat region, and we're in the third and final stage of that, although that's been delayed, which is not unusual with these collaborative type tenders, particularly when you've got more than one council and in this case a water authority involved. But Ballarat is the next regional centre that we're looking at, and there's opportunities, you know, all around Victoria.
That is Western Composting Technology Chief Executive Matt Dickens speaking with our rural reporter Timu King there, and just reiterating, said hoping to get that facility up and running fully by the start of 2027 in Huntley in central Victoria. You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour. It's time to find out what is making rural news today. We're joined by Emma Field. Good afternoon, Emma.
G'day, Annie. Residents of North and Western Queensland are being warned to prepare for significant and protracted flooding as heavy rain continues. Major flooding is already occurring in the Flinders River, with the township of Normanton in the state's Gulf Country isolated. Ashley Gallagher from Sawtell Creek Station near Normanton says he's had 450 millimetres since Christmas Eve.
The town of Normanton's had a lot more than that, and some of the places around us have had a lot more than that, so places like out at the Flinders River on the Cloncurry Road, they've had nearly 300 in a bit over 24 hours, but yeah.
You know, some people are expecting up to 500 mils over, you know, as little as 4 days. So how are you feeling about a forecast like that?
Not good. All the rivers are flooded now, you know, like the rivers are over bridges and stuff like that. So places are isolated. We've got if it comes any, well, it will come higher because it's now starting to rain up in the catchment. So, yeah, we need a little bit of a break in the weather to get some helicopters up here and shift some cattle. Pretty disappointed in the bomb website. We've got all these automatic readers on the rivers to tell us what's coming. And on the Norman River, there's like 4 or 5 of them that aren't working or not reading. On the Flinders River, there's like 7 of them that aren't working. Like, it's kind of hard to, we all know it's going to come, but yeah, it's a little bit harder to prepare if you don't know if they've already got rain or not up there. Yeah, so I don't know how they make it work, but a lot of these readers weren't working last wet season either, so it looks like nobody's done anything in the dry time.
Let's go to New South Wales now, where new gun laws were passed in that state on Christmas Eve following the Bondi shooting. Gun owners will generally be restricted to owning 4 guns, while farmers and professional shooters can have up to 10 weapons, but will have to be part of a gun club, and gun owners must be Australian citizens. Firearms that allow multiple shots without reloading, similar to those used by the alleged Bondi shooters, will also be banned, and gun licences will need to be renewed every 2 years, allowing greater scrutiny by police. Southwest Shooting Supplies owner Matthew Corkhill says while some changes are overdue, others will create a lot more work for lawful gun owners.
I think a reclassification needed to happen. In my opinion, that was possibly all that needed to happen. Look, I think there's certainly going to be teething problems. I think it needs to be given a lot more thought rather than just rushing in and getting something over the line for the sake of it. I think things there will need to be some serious adjustments at different stages. I mean, the legislation's fairly complex anyway, even without introducing more, you know. So,
and what about this idea that everybody, including farmers, would have to become members of a gun club?
I think that's going to create a hell of a lot more work. And, I mean, we've got a terrific gun club here that's 100 members strong, which is quite a few for a small community. It'll be more work for us. I mean, they can become a member if they want to. I mean, that's absolutely fine. But, I mean, we're not psychologists or psychiatrists. We can't tell. So it's going to, you've got to take a step back before that. And if they've got a license, okay, so if they've jumped that hurdle, there's no reason why they can't join a gun club. But I'm not sure what that's going to achieve either, to be perfectly honest.
Let's go to Tassie now, where it's been dry on the east coast and some farmers are being forced to feed livestock in some areas. Ellie Dunbabin farms at Little Swanport on the east coast and explains the conditions that they've faced.
You know, we had a really warm winter that's kind of come into a cold spring. It's come right up north, but we're still definitely a bit dry here. And, you know, that's reflected the bush around the place, like at Dolphin Sands, as we've seen, having a bit of a tough start to the summer. That's, yeah, definitely what we're noticing.
How's that reflected in the way that you're handling your sheep at the moment?
Probably over the last 18 months, we have dropped our numbers. I mean, that's probably twofold in terms of taking a little bit of advantage of those stronger meat prices, but as well, you know, just offloading to get the tucker up a bit. You know, our September lambs have done pretty well, actually. We've got a mixed enterprise, so we're able to move resources across things reasonably well. So we've obviously got the vineyard and cellar door side. And, you know, with the wool prices, you know, staying steady, a small uptick, you know, we can sort of lean on our other enterprises while there's a bit of a lull in those other areas.
That wraps up Rural News.
Thank you, Emma. That is Emma Field with today's Rural News. Let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology now to find out some more information about the weather. We're joined by Daniel Sherwin-Simpson, the senior forecaster at The Bomb today. Good afternoon, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Annie.
Well, last time we spoke to the Bureau, it was Wednesday, Christmas Eve, so we had that cold Christmas, and it looks like things have warmed up quite a bit since then.
Yeah, we're pretty much on the opposite front since Christmas. We've warmed up quite a bit, particularly in the southwest. They're seeing very above average temperatures. For example, Mortlake currently is seen at 34.6. Now, that's, you know, not grossly hot in the grand scheme of things compared to places like Mildura, but for the southwest in particular, those are some very above average temperatures where it's normally a little bit cooler. So certainly warm across the entire state, and we're going to see these warmer conditions continue until tomorrow across sort of central, northern and eastern parts of the state. But we are going to start to see a cool change push through tomorrow. So that'll move through the southwest in the morning, possibly making it up into the Wimmera and central parts in the afternoon, then more broadly extending across the state in the evening. Although that cool change probably won't clear out in the northeast until Wednesday or so. So you might still get a little bit more heat lingering around in the early afternoon on Wednesday if you're up in the northeast of the state. But once we see that change fully move through, generally we're looking at sort of near average temperatures for the next couple of days. We do warm up a little bit on Friday and Saturday, but it does cool back down after that. Not the sort of heat that we've seen over these last few days and certainly coming up. Just with that heat, we do have some elevated fire dangers. Currently, no districts are forecast for an extreme fire danger, but we are seeing a couple get a bit close. Most notably, the Wimmera tomorrow is nudging up at 46 out of 50. 50 is where you get an extreme fire danger rating. So that's something to keep an eye on when those fire danger forecasts come out this afternoon around 5 o'clock or so. But otherwise, in terms of what we're seeing with this change, a little bit of wind coming through. We could see an isolated storm or two about the Alps on Thursday and then more broadly about the northeast on Wednesday, but not expecting much rainfall, if any, with this change moving through.
So back to hot summer days and, yeah, not any rain really on the horizon.
Yeah, if you're hankering out for that rainfall, you're probably, unless you're in the northeast of the state, you probably won't be getting any for at least a while coming up. Yeah, certainly in the drier period, we have seen it be a bit dry recently with the odd wet day, but yeah, definitely more settled kind of summery conditions have well and truly established across the state. We'll just flag up one more thing quickly as we move into New Year's Eve. Just if you're wanting a forecast out for New Year's sort of midnight time, temperature-wise, broadly looking in the sort of 10 to 15 range across the south. A little bit cooler in the southwest, they might see some single digits. If you're north of the divide, you're more sort of going to be in that kind of 15 to 20 degree range by the time of midnight on Wednesday. So not icy cold New Year's either, but certainly not like a summer scorcher or anything like that.
Definitely bring a jacket when you go out. I had to look up when New Year's Eve was this week because I'm working all week. It's Wednesday night. I was like, when is that?
I'm with you, Annie. At this time of year, I struggle to understand what day of the week it is. I only realised it was a Monday of about 10 minutes ago, seeing as I'm a shift worker. Any day can be whenever.
That's it. It's also this odd week between Christmas and New Year's where time seems to not really exist in a normal way. Yeah. Daniel, anything else we need to know? No warnings out today, it looks like.
Yeah, look, well, all clear on the warning front. I think, yeah, just the one thing weather-wise to watch out for is that elevated heat today and tomorrow with the risk of elevated fire dangers, particularly tomorrow as that change moves through.
No problem. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Cheers. Thanks, Annie.
That's Daniel Sherwin-Simpson, the senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, giving us the update there. Maybe a bit of a chilly. And also reminding us all that it is Monday, the days between Christmas and New Year. And New Year is Wednesday night, if you also needed a quick reminder on what's coming up this week. You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour. My name is Annie Brown. It's 20 minutes to one. Now, the director of the Victorian Drought Resilience Adoption and Innovation Hub says this summer weather is giving farmers whiplash. In the last few weeks, we've gone from 40-degree days to 80 millimetres of flash flooding, and for some, it's a lifeline, and for others, it's devastating. Dr. Sarah Healy said this is part of the uncertain period of the drought cycle, and it brings a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety.
It's just been anything from scorching hot to freezing cold to dry as a chip and flooding rains, like I think, you know, all of those things we know about farming in Australian environments we've experienced, and even across the last 12 months. In some places in southwest Victoria, they've had what's called a failed autumn break for a third year in a row. And that's sort of unprecedented. In fact, they've never experienced conditions like that before. Others, we've seen some really, you know, average conditions, you know, from an irrigation point of view, the water storages are relatively good and they're business as usual. And then we see all this patchiness across the northeast of Victoria and southeast of Victoria into Gippsland, where, you know, literally within 100 kilometres of each other, one farmer's doing okay, one's really not. So it's a very difficult set of conditions to say is occurring. You know, it's very, yeah, almost random is how I'd describe it.
And that's similar to reports, I guess, we hear on the Country Hour as well. You know, even this week it's been flash flooding in some parts and, you know, it's helped a lot of people's seasons, but then it's held up a lot of people for harvest as well. So there's always a winner and a loser, it seems, to come out of any sort of weather event at the moment.
Yeah, and what we see and hear regularly is this uncertainty in terms of our climate at the moment. We traditionally have viewed drought in three stages, which is in drought, obviously, and not in drought, which is sort of like what is predicted in average year, and then recovery. But we've found in the last 4.5 years more and more farmers and farming communities talking about there's this wedge of uncertainty all around those three stages. And that phase, the uncertain phase, seems to be the most challenging and creates the most mental health, you know, in terms of anxiety and stress, and that therefore impacts decision-making. So we are seeing that very clearly in the last 12 months, in the last 6 months even, it has intensified. So it's really, that's our focus in the Vic Hub, is to really dive into that and support farmers where it's needed.
With this year and the drought that we've experienced in Victoria, have you seen an increase in people reaching out to the hub?
Oh, absolutely. Given the title, it came as no surprise, particularly down in the southwest, that we were getting direct contacts from farmers saying, really struggling here, not sure who to contact, and you've got drought in your title. And it's true, and we're very happy to link, particularly if they're looking for immediate support, like a response type support, we'll refer them to an AgVic or a state government representative, and they can give them access to whatever grants or funding supports available. We don't provide that directly, but we then will link them with that local farming systems group that can then literally drive down the driveway and check on them and invite them to events to help them with management decisions on their farm. So, yeah, we saw a significant increase and that continued, which is interesting because I think not only are people thinking about drought, thinking about climate, but it's occurring across the state, not just in places where they're getting impacted immediately by drought.
In the long term, what are some of the gaps, do you think, in the drought resilience sort of strategy that we have?
I think we've tended to believe or understand that drought occurs in set phases. Like I said, the good, the bad, and the recovery. And we've realised that at each of those stages, there's this really grey, uncertain period. And that then translates into what sorts of management decisions need to be made there. And that's very sector specific. So that might be different for livestock to broadacre grain production, to dairy and to horticulture. And so we've started building decision matrices or frameworks to help in those stages, the drought, the average year, the recovery and the uncertain period. What are the key decision points and things that farmers need to consider and make that a consistent approach that we can then communicate to farmers who experience whatever time of a drought they're in. We've found that really powerful, but it has been a huge gap, and we're seeing more and more uptake of that type of flexible, adaptive decision-making in farmers, and that's just going to really be so important for them for the future, is to keep that adaptive thinking going, even when things are really, really stressful.
Sarah, we're in the uncertain period at the moment. What comes after this?
I'd like to think that things will return to what is a normal year, if that's possible. We're hearing from the Bureau of Met that there are places in Australia where there are new normals being created. So what we have known for many, many years is when rainfall will fall, such as an autumn break and or a wet spring in certain parts of Victoria, those patterns are shifting and we're not even sure to what extent. So I guess what we'd love to think is that there'll be a period where things sort of happen at times that are expected and farmers can get back on their feet and start preparing for when we go into another phase of uncertainty. Sometimes we're not that lucky, and we've certainly seen that up in the northeast where this spring has been what we call a failed spring, and it's normally very predictable in the northeast around this time, and harvest gets done before Christmas and everyone can just relax, and that's not happening this year. So as optimistic as I'd like to think that we give these farming communities a bit of certainty for a while, we're probably in a state where there's some new norms occurring. And that's why that adaptive, flexible thinking is just going to be critical.
That is Dr. Sarah Healy there. She's the director of the Victorian Drought Resilience Adoption and Innovation Hub, speaking to me there. Let's head to Gippsland now. A South Gippsland kinder is nurturing the next generation of dairy experts and advocates. It's the first time the Leongatha Community Preschool is running its Dairy in Kinder program, which aims to teach our littlest Victorians about farming, sustainability and healthy eating. Faith Tabaluyan has this story.
I've learned that the milk gets processed.
How does it get processed?
A big factory.
And where does the milk come from in the first place?
The cows.
That's Campbell Wooding from Leongatha. At just 5 years old, he's already an advocate for the local dairy industry.
I was just eating cheese.
Some good cheese?
Yeah.
Campbell is among a handful of Leongatha Community Preschool students participating in a new Dairy in Kinder program, which is running for the next 12 months, funded by a $10,000 grant from the Gardner Foundation. Amy Cosby is a parent and dairy farmer from Leongatha South. She says when it comes to ag education, starting early is key.
Some people might think it's really young to be speaking about careers with, 3, 4, 5-year-olds, but we know that young people know what career they don't want to do very early. And if we don't introduce them to a range of careers in the dairy industry at this young age, it's likely that they won't consider that when they are getting to their career-making decision time in their life. So we will take kids out on excursions to dairy farms, probably ours, and also we'll bring some calves into the kinders next year during calving to show them how calves are fed. And, you know, perhaps for some of them, even though they live in a dairy region, if you are not connected with a dairy farmer personally through friends or family, you might never have been on a dairy farm, or you might never have interacted with a cow. You might not know anything about them. So by introducing it to young kids like this, they'll go home and tell their families, which is really important. And when they're in the supermarket, they're choosing to buy Australian dairy products.
Ms. Cosby's taken that approach with her own three boys, starting with 5-year-old Oscar and 4-year-old Dave.
Oscar, why do you love being a dairy farmer?
Milk the cows.
What cow do you milk?
My cow.
Xavier, what do you like about being a dairy farmer?
Cows.
What do you like about the cows, though?
Milk.
And what do you like doing in the tractor?
Cutting silage.
Bessa Wooding is the mum of Campbell, our other 5-year-old dairy expert. She and her family moved to Leongatha in 2021, keen to leave city life behind. Despite having no farming background, Ms. Wooding says she's all for more dairy education.
Yeah, really excited. I think it's great for the kids to have this opportunity, especially kids that probably don't get a lot of experience or first-hand time on farms. I think that it's going to be great for the kids to get involved.
Emily Duncan is a local parent who also sits on the Kinders fundraising committee.
We thought, why not jump on it? We have so many farms around Leongatha. What a perfect opportunity for us to capitalise on that.
Despite not working the land herself, Ms. Duncan says farming is a favourite topic in her family.
I did not grow up on a farm, but I have a close family connection with my in-laws being dairy farmers and my sister and her husband dairy farming close by in Fish Creek as well. We talk a lot about where our food comes from. We talk a lot about Pa's farm. We talk a lot about the farms around town and what they're growing and things like that. A lot of interest comes in the tractors. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter that is really interested in tractors at the moment. And at the moment it's silage season, so there's a lot of interest in the silage, whether we're baling or making a pit silage. So, yeah, a lot of the time we are talking about farms.
So how do you bring the world of dairy into the classroom? Here's teacher Belinda Elliott to explain.
All the basics of where their food comes from and simple things like farm animals. We relate it back to art projects and we incorporate it into even cooking experiences. This year we created our own butter by churning our own cream and cooking with that. We spread it onto some beautiful scones that we'd made, and it was it was a really good way for children to get a good visual in how things are made in the dairy industry.
And did the kids have a lot of questions about the butter?
Yeah, they did. Well, they were more interested in the taste testing side of things too. They enjoyed the buttermilk, which we weren't sure if we were going to like the taste of that. But they enjoyed that. They just, even the process of them being able to spread it onto their own food that they'd made and enjoy the taste. So yeah, it was a really good learning experience.
That is Belinda Elliott, Leongatha community preschool teacher, ending that story from Faith Tavalian. She went out to the Leongatha community preschool, earlier this year, I think in later November. But that is such a good little story. That little voice of the kid saying, my favourite thing on the dairy farm is cutting silage. Oh, it's very cute. Also just got a text saying, we made butter from milk during Pioneer Day by putting a marble into a jar, like shaking it for ages. So there you go. It's something that we all maybe start to do in our younger years, is learn a little bit more about dairy farming. But a great, great story there. And thanks to Faith for bringing us that story.
The Country Hour.
We exported the largest volume of lobster.
Celebrating 80 years.
Isn't that quite exciting?
The Country Hour.
Get up.
Part of your community.
Bite the bullet.
And your life.
Keep moving.
For 80 years on ABC Radio.
Time to check the markets. Let's go to our Bute bloke in Pakenham, Peter Costas. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you for the compliment, Campbell. Smaller yarding here, 531 penned, 94 less.
The market reports are a hugely popular part of the Country Hour. But did you know it wasn't always just about sheep and cattle? There used to be a fruit and veggie market report as well.
Whether we move to markets and at the fruit and vegetable markets in Melbourne, here's Ed Caruana. Well, apparently we're still trying to locate the fruit and vegetable report.
That's live radio for you. Hello, I'm Annie Brown. And listeners have been tuning in to hear the latest market information on the Country Hour since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. And the market reports used to be much longer, sometimes going for 15 minutes on fruit and vegetables alone. This is a snippet from the Country Hour in 1976.
And a very good afternoon. Alan Humphreys with the ABC's Country Hour. And highlights of today's program include a farmer's invention of an automatic gate opener, one of these systems where you drive your vehicle up to the gate and the gate automatically opens. On to interstate markets in Brisbane, overcast and sultry. Pears at $2 to $4, New South Wales lines to $5. New South Wales peaches in Brisbane, $2 to $4, specials at $4.50. New South Wales plums at $2 to $5, nectarines $3 to $6. Oranges, Valencia, $3 to $4, Murray Valley going to $4.60 a box. It's now 5 minutes past 12. That completes our interstate markets. On to the Sydney fruit market and this report from Pat McMahon.
Supplies of most fruit were only moderate today, and although trading was fairly quiet, price levels were fairly well maintained for most items, and they actually improved a little for one or two items. The apple market was well supplied and sales were fairly slow. Most shopkeepers now have New Season, Jonathan's, Delicious and Granny Smith's well stocked, and replacement sales are not up to expectations. The result is a gradual easing in prices and a carryover on most stands.
Eventually, the vegetable and fruit market reports were phased out of the programs, but were still being broadcasted into the 1990s. This is the South Australian Country Hour in 1993.
Good afternoon, Lee. Good supplies of fruit and vegetables met a quiet demand again at Paraka this morning. Today's quotations, avocados, mainly from interstate sources, Hass variety, $13 to $20 per tray, Fuerte and Charwell at $10 to $17. South Australian greenskin varieties are lower at $8 to $12 per tray. All pumpkin varieties remain steady today. White onions, $20 to $22 per bag, brown onions, $17 to $18. Premium washed white potatoes, $13 to $14. Premium washed red, $10 to $12. This is John Lewis reporting for the Country Hour.
And in some states, there would even be an update from the fish markets.
And 243 boxes at the Adelaide Wholesale Fish Market today. Whiting made $7 to $9.90 a kilogram. Garfish, $2 to $5.80. Large snapper, $6.50 to $7.50. Snook, $2 to $3. Tommy Ruff's, 80 cents to $3. Salmon, $2.30 to $2.50. Trout, $1.30 to $1.40. Sea mullet, $1 to $2.40. Coorong mullet, $0.50 to $0.80. Butterfish, $6.90. Callop, $3 to $3.80. Shark, $0.30 to $6. Squid, $4.50 to $6.30. Silvers, $3 to $4.70. Redfin, $2.50 to $3. Brim, $7.90 to $8.20. Flathead, $2.80. Flounder, $2.80 to $4. Cooked crabs, $3.50 to $3.60. Uncooked crabs, $3.50. Trevally, $2.50. Leather jackets, $1.50. And wings, $2.20 at the Adelaide Wholesale Fish Market this morning. This has been the Country Hour on ABC Regional Radio. I'm Lee Radford. It's time for the news at 1 o'clock.
Today, you can still hear updates on the wool, grain, cattle and sheep markets on your local Country Hour and rural reports around Australia. And while we celebrate our 80th anniversary, we thank all of our market reporters over the years. Thank you for bringing us the latest information from the markets. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown. Yeah, we've been talking about it a bit this year, but it is our 80th anniversary. December 3rd, 1945 was the first broadcast of the Country Hour. So we're 80 years old, if you can believe it, this year. Still going strong. And you can read up and have a listen back to some of the great coverage we've been doing in the celebration of our 80th anniversary as well. We did a whole Country Hour from Rapanyup on December 3rd. You can go back to the Victorian Country Hour podcast and have a listen to that. And then the few days leading up to that as well, we all went out and did little outdoor broadcasts broadcasts back into the Country Hour, checking in with local farmers in our region. And you can also read a little bit more online, abc.net.au/rural. We've got a whole bunch of archival stuff there, looking back at the history of the 80 years of the Country Hour. But yeah, maybe bring back the veg and fruit market reports. I don't know. Or apparently there was also a fresh cut flower market report as well that used to also go on the Country Hour. So we used to have a lot more markets. And apologies to anyone there if I did confuse you playing the little sting we play before the markets. They should be back next week here on the Country Hour. But right now, though, that's the end of the show. It's 1 o'clock. It's time to get the latest in the ABC Newsroom. Have a great rest of your afternoon.